The Vintage Gamer, Episode 12, The Fury of Dracula.
You must be listening to the Goblin Broadcast Network at gbn.com. Amazing!
Hello, and welcome to The Vintage Gamer, the podcast that seeks out great games from an earlier era. I'm your host, Jim Van Verth. The Vintage Gamer is a podcast available via RSS or direct download at www.thevintagegamer.net. Well, it's been a pretty uneventful 2 weeks here. Actually, I guess it's been 3 weeks now. I did post some news in the blog about The Escapist, which is, as far as I can tell, relatively old, relatively being 1 year old, gaming e-magazine that I only just discovered, which I'm somewhat embarrassed about, particularly since it seems to be published from Durham. And I did manage to pick up, well, I did order, anyway, a copy of the Oxford History of Board Games for a decent price. The seller's on vacation and in Britain, so I probably won't get it into my eager little hands until late June. I do think it will be useful because I'm planning a show on books about vintage games, so I'll feature that one, of course. And thinking The Game Makers, which is a history of Parker Brothers, maybe a book about Monopoly, and some others. If you do have any suggestions, let me know. One important note is that for iTunes listeners, the promo may have displaced show number 9. What I did was I posted show 9 first, and then the promo, and since iTunes only gets the latest podcasts, well, you get the idea. Most everybody got the promo, as far as I can tell. So, if you didn't hear the show about Barbarian Prince, then you may want to go download that one through iTunes. Well, that's about it for news. As I said, there's not much going on. And this is going to be a long show, so after this brief break, we'll get to the game.
Warning, the following information is classified top secret. Well, okay, that's not true, but we think it's cool just to tell you that. The subject of this dossier is Random Signal, a podcast produced from an underground Super Ultra Mondo secret facility located somewhere in the Durham, North Carolina area of the Mid-Atlantic United States. Its host is Jason Adams, codenamed Kryptonaut, called by some as a rebel, a geek, and a spitting image of Jane from Joss Whedon's Firefly. Random Signal is a podcast for the independent musician, offering a platform for music too good for the mainstream music industry. More data can be obtained on the Random Signal at randomsignal.com. It is your mission to fill your podcatching client with many episodes of Random Signal, a podcast that is so totally Airwolf that Ernest Borgnine is starting up a Backstreet Boys tribute band just so he can get an interview on it. Subscribing to Random Signal is your first priority. End of file.
So, the game this week, as I said, is The Furies of Dracula. The Furies of Dracula was originally published by Games Workshop, and was originally published by... hang on a sec here. Hello? Oh, hi! I'm recording right now. Okay. Yes, yeah, I know that it's The Fury of Dracula. It's a joke. Yes, yeah, I know. Scott on Board Games already made that joke. Look, I planned to make it weeks ago. I just could... Yeah. All right, but... Okay, yeah, all right. Bye now. Sorry about that. All right, I admit, it's a bad joke, but I couldn't resist. Anyway, the game is Fury of Dracula, originally published by Games Works... Now what? Okay, excuse me just a sec here. All right, hold on. Yes, I know that the Games Workshop version is The Fury of Dracula, and the Fantasy Flight version is Fury of Dracula. Well, I was getting to it. Look, if you would just stop interrupting, maybe I could get through this and explain it to everyone, okay? All right, great. Thank you for... Yeah. I know. Okay, look. I'll talk to you later, Mom. I love you. Bye. All right. As the caller made clear, there are really two versions of this game. The original, published by Games Workshop, and the new, / reprint version, published by Fantasy Flight. For the basis of this podcast, I'm going to spend most of the time introducing the original version of the game, and then talk about how the new version differs. The Fury of Dracula was first published in 1987 by Games Workshop and designed by Stephen Hand. It is a semi-cooperative game, which is to say that one player acts as Dracula, and the other three players work against him as hunters. The hunters are Lord Godalming, Dr. Seward, and Van Helsing. It can be played with fewer than four players, but some or all of the hunters double up on characters, or triple up in the case of a two-player game. It's basically Dracula versus all three. Now, each side has different goals. Dracula's goal is to create six vampires, either by placing them as hidden encounters or turning the hunters themselves into vampires. And in this case, he bites the hunters twice or kills them when they're already bitten once. Now, the hunter's goal is to destroy Dracula by reducing his blood points to zero, or better yet, just killing him with a stake or knife. Their goal is made more difficult by the fact that Dracula spends most of the game hidden. This is similar to the design of Scotland Yard, which almost certainly was an inspiration, where one player is Mr. X and the rest of the players are agents of Scotland Yard tracking him down. In many ways, The Fury of Dracula is Scotland Yard with a lot of flavorful chrome stacked on top. The game is played on a map of Europe. Think a smaller version of the diplomacy map and you'll have the right idea. The land areas are broken into cities with road and rail connections between them, and coastal cities marked as ports. Each city is either a large or small city, and the size of each city controls what sort of items that the hunters can get there, and cover a little more on that later. The sea areas are broken into spaces, such as the Mediterranean, the North Sea, and so on. The hunters move their pieces openly in this map, while Dracula moves behind a screen, and he does this on a chart representing the spaces on the board. As he moves, he leaves hidden encounters, one of which is the aforementioned vampires, which are also placed on the chart. What happens is, if a hunter moves to that location, then Dracula reveals the encounter, and the hunter must deal with it before doing anything else. This allows the hunters to track Dracula's movement, while also allowing Dracula to impede the hunter's progress. Now, Dracula must also place a special marker which indicates his previous location. If the hunters uncover this, then they know he must be somewhere neighboring that space. And if they encounter the space where Dracula's hiding, then combat begins. And that's pretty much the game right there. Now, the turn order is actually fixed by the characters. It's not randomly determined. And it is as follows. Dracula goes first, followed by the hunters, in this order, Lord Godalming, Dr. Seward, and Van Helsing. Each player turn consists of two phases. There's movement, and there's action. Doesn't matter if you're Dracula or the hunters. Both are movement, then action. Now, movement is done via land or sea. On land, hunters can take roads, which only allow them to move to a neighboring city, or they can take the train, which allows them to move up to three spaces, depending on the roll of a die. Dracula, on the other hand, never takes the train. It is unseemly. Traveling by sea is done by embarking from a port city and then moving across sea spaces one per turn until a different port city is reached. Dracula's movement is the same there. It's just that he takes 1 point of damage when embarking, but no damage after that unless certain event cards are played. Now, I've mentioned that while the hunter's movement is on the board, Dracula's is behind a screen. What he does is he takes his piece off the current location on his chart and moves it to the new location, and this represents his hidden location on the board. He then takes the special local rumors chit, which indicates his previous location, and places it at his old location. And note that with this system, he can double back across his path. He can start at one city, and then go to another, and then go back to the first city again. Almost immediately. He can also stay in the same place if he likes. This is not the case in the new version. So that's the movement phase. Now, while movement is fairly similar between the two sides, ignoring the hidden part and, you know, the damage to Dracula, the action phase is rather different. During Dracula's action phase, he has three possibilities. If he has moved to a sea space, he can do nothing at this point. If he's on a land space and there are any hunters in his current space, then he must attack them. He has no choice and can do nothing else. And finally, if there is no hunter and no encounter on the hidden chart at his current location, then he can place one from his hand and draw a new one. And Dracula starts with five random encounters in his hand. During a hunter's action phase, again, like Dracula, if he has moved to a sea space, he can do nothing. Otherwise, as I mentioned, if there is an encounter at the space, Dracula will reveal it, and then the hunter must deal with it. The encountered chits vary from agents, such as Tsigani and servants. The Tsigani are another word for the gypsies. These engage the hunters in combat, which I'll cover in a moment. And then there are animals, such as rats or wolves, which have a simple die roll to determine damage results. And then there's some environmental effects, such as storm, bats, or fog, which can confound or slow down the hunter. However, the most important encounter, I've already mentioned, is called Vampire. If Dracula ever has six of these on his chart, then he wins the game. So because of this, if a hunter encounters one, then he'll want to destroy it, which I'll cover in a bit. If resolving the encounter leads to it being removed, or if there is no encounter, then the hunter can search for Dracula. At this point, if Dracula is at the location, or there's a local rumors chit there, then these are revealed. If Dracula is revealed, then the hunter can choose to enter into combat with Dracula. Which brings us to combat, finally. Combat between the hunters and Dracula begins by determining whether it's day or night by rolling a die. There's a 50-50 chance either way. The result of the die roll controls the attacks available to Dracula. At night, he gets many more attacks, and hence is more powerful, which fits. Obviously, he should be weaker during the daytime. After that, combat is handled by a series of rounds, and this only ends if one side is killed or escapes. The first part is that each side secretly chooses one combat chit from those available. Dracula gets a set depending on whether he's fighting at night or day, and the hunter gets his three basic attacks, which are dodge, punch, or escape, plus any weapon chits he has picked up, which I'll explain that in a minute too. And the chit chosen represents the action that will be taking in this round. Now, one important restriction is that the chit used in the previous round cannot be used in the current round. The next step is that each side rolls an initiative die. Now, note that the result can be modified by certain event cards, which must be played before the die roll. Dracula also gets a +1 initiative modifier if the hunter is bitten. Now, the side with the greatest modified result wins the initiative and thus the attack. Basically, their action is the action that is applied. The chits are revealed simultaneously, and the result is looked up on the winning side's combat table. And this result depends on the attack used by the losing side. And if the result of that is that neither side has died or escaped, then combat continues with another round. I will throw out an example later to try to make this a little clearer. Combat between the hunters and Dracula's agents is similar. The difference is that there is no role for day and night, because the agents don't get any special attacks, and the hunters can't use their full set of attacks. For example, crucifixes don't do anything. They're only useful against Dracula, because he's a vampire. There is a different set of chits used by Dracula for the agents, as I mentioned. This means that a different set of combat tables is used as well, but otherwise combat proceeds in pretty much the same manner. So once all encounters and combat is resolved, or again, if there's nothing there, then the hunter, assuming that he's not at a special space called Castle Dracula, can draw weapon chits or event cards. He can draw one or two items in a large town or one item in a small town. So he could draw in a large town, he could draw a weapon chit and an event card, or he could draw two event cards, or he could draw two weapon cards. Now the weapon items, as I mentioned, are used in combat, whereas event cards are either applied immediately, depending what it says on the card, or they can be held in the hand to be used at a later time. A hunter can only have 3 weapons at one time, so if the hunter does draw more than that, then he must discard back down to 3. One thing about the events is that they are special. There are cards for Dracula or the Hunter, and these have different back art and are shuffled into the same deck. So when the Hunter draws an event card, he draws it from the bottom of the deck so that the front is not revealed. And looking at the back, if it is for Dracula, he hands it over unseen. Otherwise, he takes it for himself and may show it to the other Hunters. The sorts of things you might find on event cards, they can counteract some sort of bad event that has happened to you, like there are some that will heal you, or they can give you bonuses in certain situations, such as combat, as I mentioned before. So, just to kind of run down and give you an example of some of these cards and what might happen during a round of play, here's a quick example. Dracula begins his turn in Geneva, and he kind of feels the pursuit is healed, so he decides to move to Paris via road. He can't take the railroad, remember. He moves his figure from the Geneva Square to this Paris Square on his chart, and then moves the local rumors chit to the Geneva Square. That's his movement, and as his action, he places a vampire encounter on the Paris Square, as there wasn't already an encounter there, and then draws a new encounter chit. Lord Godalming is next, and he moves via road from Milan to Geneva, trying to hunt out where Dracula might be. Now, for some reason, there's no encounter there, so Lord Godalming can search for Dracula. Perhaps the reason is that I didn't want to deal with it in this case. Now, at this point, Dracula shows the local rumors chit, indicating that he was at that space in the previous turn. And finally, Lord Godalming draws one event card since he is in a small city. And it turns out to be a hunter card, which is played immediately, called Newspaper Reports. And this forces Dracula to reveal his location to all hunters. How convenient. Begrudgingly, Dracula does so and places his figure on the board at Paris. It is now Dr. Seward's turn, and he's too far away to travel by road to catch Dracula at Paris, so he tries to take the train. But alas, he rolls a 1 and so loses his turn, thus saving time in the summary. This also gives a chance for Van Helsing to go. He is in Marseille, and also attempts to take the train to Paris. He rolls a 5, lucky ducky, which allows him to move 2 spaces, but he chooses to only move the 1 space and get off at Paris. He first has to deal with the vampire encounter. He has a knife and a stake, so he can try to slay the vampire. If he didn't have a knife or a stake, then the vampire would just bite him immediately. Now, normally, he would have to roll to avoid the bite, even having the knife or stake, but he has a crucifix, so success is automatic. He discards the knife, because he had to use that to kill the vampire, and the vampire is destroyed and discarded. The encounter dealt with, he can now search for Dracula, and clearly, he's on the board, and so combat begins. As mentioned, first Dracula rolls a die to determine the time of day. He rolls a 3, and so it's daytime. Because of this, Dracula only has 3 combat chits available to him: claw, dodge, and escape as human. If it were night, he could also use escape as a bat, escape as a mist, fangs, hypnotize, or strength. Van Helsing has his basic combat chips, as I mentioned, dodge, escape, and punch, also called fist, I guess, plus the crucifix and stake. So Dracula secretly chooses claw as his first combat move, and Van Helsing chooses the stake. He just wants to get right down to business. They roll for initiative, and Van Helsing already has 1 bite, so Dracula gets a +1 to initiative. However, Van Helsing plays an advanced planning event card, which he had in his hand, and this gives him a +1 as well for just this round. But to no avail, as Dracula rolls a 5 and Van Helsing a 4, and giving Dracula the initiative. They reveal their chits and look up the result on the Dracula Wins chart. Cross-referencing Van Helsing's move of the stake, we see that he takes 3 more points of damage, and he only has 2 hit points. Did I mention that? Well, he only has 2 hit points. So it should kill him and turn him into a vampire. But Van Helsing plays another event, Great Strength, which cancels out the damage given, and he continues for another turn. The next combat turn, Dracula chooses dodge and Van Helsing the crucifix. In this case, Van Helsing actually wins the initiative, and Dracula takes 1 point in blood damage from the crucifix. Finally, Dracula and Van Helsing again choose claw and the stake, respectively, and this time Van Helsing wins the initiative and kills Dracula. At last, Van Helsing's long quest is over. Now, there were a few things in that description I didn't cover, mainly wounds and death. Each hunter has essentially 12 hit points. I believe it's 12. I couldn't find the actual hunter sheet, so I had to look at some rather unclear pictures to figure this out. But you get the general sense. However, in this case, it's actually represented in reverse, where each hunter takes up to 12 wounds. I'm not sure why they didn't start at 12 and count down, but in any case. Now, after 12 wounds, the hunter is dead, and play just stops for that player. The hunters can also be bitten, though, as I mentioned, which is represented by a bite marker, which is placed on their character card. And as I mentioned, if a bitten hunter dies, or if that hunter is bitten again, they become a vampire and a pawn of Dracula. At this point, their play is done as well, but in addition, the piece is placed on that location on Dracula's movement chart, and can be dealt with as if it were a vampire chit, assuming that there are any hunters left, of course. This vampire also counts towards the total needed for Dracula to win. It's probably a good point for me to mention here that I guess another winning condition for Dracula is to kill all of the hunters. I mean, there's nobody else to defeat him at that point. Now, as far as Dracula's damage, Dracula has, again, I can't find the graphic of his sheet, I think 12 blood points. Again, basically, these are hit points. If these blood points hit zero, then he needs to immediately try to escape to that special space, Castle Dracula, and stay there for 3 turns. If he manages this, then the hunters do still win the game, but in theory he will rise again in 100 years. It's a lesser victory for the hunters, basically. The way to get a full hunter victory is to kill Dracula by using the stake or the knife. The stake is more risky. The hunter can take more damage if he doesn't gain the initiative in that case, but it is more likely to get the job done. Most of the results when using a stake end up in Dracula's death. There are some other points I've skimmed over here. For example, the hunters can join together and move and attack as a group. Plus, there are some ways for individual hunters to get the win, basically build up what are called valor points. But overall, that's pretty much the game. Now, normally at this point, I would, of course, give some sort of review or session report, but the unfortunate bit is that I can't really review it because I don't actually own the game in this form. The best I can personally do is to compare it to the new version, which is I'll be covering next. I can, however, guess at some problems based on other reviews and just comparing the two versions. The biggest one is that, well, Dracula can cheat, or, you know, in more mild cases, can screw up. And the players will never know. In theory, he can move anywhere he wants, or just not tell players if they encounter him. And there's really no way for them to tell. Which is no fun for the hunters. I suppose it could be fun for Dracula if you enjoy torturing people, which I guess if you're Dracula, you might. Another big one is how day and night are handled. Since it's completely random, there's really no strategy as to when you might want to attack Dracula if you're the hunter. And the same is true for Dracula. For all you know, Dracula could be at his most powerful or at his weakest. Now, there are event cards that can force the issue, but it's not really clear when and what order you can play them in. And finally, there's nothing stopping the game from going on and on and on. As long as the hunters keep killing the vampires and Dracula keeps escaping, there's really no end in sight. Now, a lot of these issues are dealt with in the new version, which I will get to right after this.
I'm Mark Kinney.
And I'm Chris Heim.
And we have a podcast called All Games Considered. All Games Considered is a show about tabletop gaming in all its forms.
We don't really talk about video games.
In fact, we don't at all.
We try to stick to a certain theme in each show.
And sometimes we even succeed.
We're not that bad, are we?
Yes, we're an irreverent bi-weekly taste of gaming.
We'll help you find some free games out there. Maybe some rare, little-known games?
We'll tell you how to improve your games by ripping off the mass media.
We have special guests once in a while.
Or at least we hope to.
We'll even tell you where to find a convention or two.
Check out our webpage at allgamesconsidered.blogspot.com. You'll find links to the shows and our RSS feeds.
We're also available through iTunes.
All Games Considered is a proud member of the Sci-Fi Podcast Network and the Gaming Podcast Network. So remember, allgamesconsidered.blogspot.com.
Now to Fury of Dracula, the Fantasy Flight Edition. I mentioned during the GDC reports that I attended a keynote given by Ron Moore, executive producer of the new Battlestar Galactica. The topic of the talk, and yes, this is pertinent, was taking an existing franchise and maintaining the core of the old show while updating it. In his case, the core is the desperate flight of humanity, the kind of aircraft carrier in space notion, and the family Adama. Updating it means taking out some of the inappropriate cheesiness. I mean, it is the end of humanity, after all. Adding some conflict to make the family more interesting, and generally giving it a darker and more ambiguous tone, which is more fitting for these times. For this game, for Fury of Dracula, the core is the Hunter versus Dracula dichotomy, plus the hunt across Europe and the combat. Updating the game means improving the movement of Dracula to make him easier to track and, more importantly, harder for him to cheat. Moving some of the combat from the tables to cards, which makes it flow a little bit faster, and a few minor tweaks to ensure the game will eventually end and make the day-night cycle a little more predictable. As with the show, the rest of what the game is follows from those changes. So, as mentioned, having Dracula move behind a screen was problematic because of possibility of cheating or screwing up. To fix this, he's given a hand of cards, one for each location. The land locations are marked with a tan background and the sea with blue, so the hunters will know when Dracula is traveling by ship. Again, in the original, there was no way of telling that other than he took blood damage at one point. After that, you have no real idea that he's traveling by water or land. Instead of placing a chit on a chart to move, he places the card face down on a track with seven spaces. This is called Dracula's Trail. On top of that, he places a face-down chit for the encounter, and then the Dracula figure to indicate that this is his current location. Each turn after that, he places a new card next to the previous one, a new encounter, and then moves the Dracula figure over. So when a hunter moves to a location that is hidden on the trail, or a card is played that reveals a location, for example, again, newspaper reports, or a card is played that reveals an encounter, i.e. there's another one that says, "Where all the vampires?" Actually, I think that is newspaper reports. Anyway, the appropriate card or encounter is turned over in that case. So it is possible to reveal just an encounter without revealing the location of that encounter. Now, in the original game, encounters stuck around, hidden behind the screen. So Dracula could move all over the place, he could do any number of turns, and the encounters would just stay there until a hunter ran into them. In this game, when the trail fills up, the oldest location is actually removed from the trail. The remaining cards are slid over, and then the newest card is played. This means that encounters also come off the board. And to allow some of the gameplay effect of the original game, in particular creating vampires, Dracula can do two things at this point. The first thing is that the encounter can be matured. In this case, the card goes back into Dracula's hand, the encounter back into the pile, and any special matured abilities of the encounter are applied. Now, most encounters don't have any matured effect, but of the three that have them, the most interesting is, of course, I keep talking about them, the vampires. In this game, they actually add 2 points to Dracula's score. So again, it is in the hunter's best interest to get rid of them. The other encounters with maturing abilities allow him to draw up to 2 event cards or play an encounter directly on a hunter, which is very powerful. Now, the second possibility, other than maturing the encounter, is that the location card is placed, still face down, on one of 3 special spaces called the Catacombs. This allows the encounter to stick around as well. In addition, Dracula can add another encounter to the location, making it doubly nasty. However, if you do this as Dracula, no matured effect will be applied, so this action doesn't make much sense for those types of encounters. Now, this card does not stay in the catacombs forever if no hunter runs across it. If need be, Dracula can remove any of the cards from the catacombs and place them back into his hand. Now, another big change is that in the first game, because you reveal encounters first, you can know that an encounter is at a space, but not necessarily Dracula, if you don't get past the encounter. In the second edition, when a hunter is moved to a space in Dracula's trail, you must turn over the location card to reveal it. And since Dracula is always in the last space on the track, the hunters will know if he is there or not. Now, they may not be able to get to him, depending on what the encounter is, but they will know he is there. And this does make Dracula a little bit easier to track. Another effect that the card system has is that Dracula can only move to spaces that are in his hand. So, if a card is already down in the trail, that means he can't play it again. And this means he can't normally double back like he could in the original game, nor can he stay in the location. So, to help him be a little more sneaky, he's given some special movement cards. The first is Hide, which is a card with the same back as the land cards. And this allows Dracula to stay in the previous location, assuming, of course, that it is a land location, and double up the encounter there. Another is Double Back, which allows him to replay a card that is already in his trail, as long as the movement from his current location is a legal one. Wolf Form is a card that can only be played at night and costs Dracula 1 blood point. However, it allows him to move up to 2 spaces, and he can pass through a city that contains a hunter. So basically, if the hunters try to corner Dracula and kind of build this line across, he can jump across the line by using the wolf form. The other two special powers, Dark Call and Feed, are not really movement powers, but they allow him to stay where he is and draw encounter markers and regain blood, respectively. Note that for the cards other than Hide, it will be clear to the other players that Dracula is using this ability. He places them on the track like a normal movement card, and then for the ones that allow additional movement, he places a normal movement card on top. And also note that the ones that don't allow movement, Dark Call and Feed, he cannot place an encounter on top either. That's about all the changes that follow from getting rid of the movement chart. Now, combat is about the same. You pick an attack, you roll to see whose attack succeeds, and then apply the result from the winner's attack by cross-referencing the loser's attack. The differences are as follows. First, to keep the day-night cycle from being so random, a clock is added to the game, which advances on Dracula's turn and indicates the current time of day. There are 3 day spaces and 3 night spaces, and the game begins in the daytime. And there are some cards which allow you to slow down time, basically keep it daytime or keep it nighttime, depending if you're the hunters or Dracula. The combat chits have been replaced with combat cards, and this allows for more information to be displayed on them. For example, as before, you roll for the attack and the highest modified roll wins. But now there is also an initiative value indicated on each card, which is used to break ties. The combat card with the higher initiative, in this case, wins. And instead of looking up the result in a table, the result is actually written on your card. So if you attack with a stake, and Dracula attacks with his fangs, you look on your card under fangs to see the result if you win. Now, there is a disadvantage to this, because you can't see the effect if you lose the combat. You can only see the effect if you win. Because of this, some people have created a combat chart where you can look up the result, and it's available on BGG, and I'll, of course, put a link in the show notes. Now, some of the health status stuff has changed a little bit. You can no longer kill Dracula immediately with a stake or knife. Instead, they knock off blood points to the next level of 5. So, for example, if Dracula had 7 blood points, he would drop down to 5. If he had 12, he would drop down to 10. And, of course, if he's at or below 5, he drops down to 0. Which means he's dead, finally. The goal of the hunters, then, is to drop Dracula's blood points down to 0. and that will drop quickly if you're using the stake and the knife, or it will whittle down, you know, 1 or 2 points at a time if you're using other weapons. Now, for the hunters, if they lose all their health or are bitten twice, they are defeated, and Dracula just scores 2 points. There's no more turning them into vampires. The hunter will lose all their items and event cards, and they'll move to a new space on the board called the hospital, and they lose their next turn. Now, this is actually kind of nice because it does allow the players to continue playing the game. There's no elimination in this. But, you know, it's kind of bad because sometimes elimination is a good opportunity to wander into the kitchen and raid the refrigerator. I often find that death makes me hungry. And the remainder of the game changes are really just tweaks. With the exception of the cards, movement is pretty much the same. Except that the train chart has been replaced by a train die that contains the same information. Even the board is pretty much the same, other than the addition of the hospital. I sat down and I really couldn't find any difference between the rail connections or the road connections. One other change is that Dracula now takes damage every other sea space, instead of just taking damage when he embarks. And this can actually be increased to every sea space by a special card. And I'll tell you, playing as Dracula, that card is really annoying. Now, I did mention that there is a time limit now, to keep the game from dragging on forever. As each day passes without Dracula being slain, he gains another point. Basically, he's survived another day. And this is in addition to the 2 points he gains for every defeated hunter and the 2 points for every matured vampire. This actually has changed his winning conditions, too. He wins after 6 points. So, by default, Dracula wins the game if the game lasts for 6 days, or basically 36 turns. Now, to counteract this point accumulation, you know, Dracula just gets free points, essentially, the hunters get a point of resolve, which is a new quantity each day, which they can spend on virtual event cards. One example is newspaper reports, as I mentioned, which just shows where Dracula is and where his vampires are. Another new feature, which I'm not exactly sure about, I'm not sure it was completely necessary, is allies. In the new game, there are more event cards, on both sides, that can act as allies and stick around on the board. Each side can have one ally active at a time, and these give bonuses to your side or minuses to the other. One example is the card that I mentioned, I don't remember the name of the ally, but it is a hunter ally that causes Dracula to take damage for every C move. I guess it's nice having another modifier to the game to kind of mix things up, but I don't know, kind of feels like a bit of unnecessary chrome to me. Maybe there is a design rationale for it, but I'm actually not seeing it. And finally, like Battlestar Galactica, it was decided that Fury of Dracula needed a little more female mightiness to it. So, like Battlestar added Starbuck as a woman, here a new character is added, Mina Harker. Now, she's a rather interesting character in that she's already bitten, which means that Dracula, I didn't actually mention this effect, I guess, but anyway, Dracula does get to see one of her items and event cards, and gets to play certain events on her. But it also means that she can use the hypnosis card to try to track Dracula. Again, another effect I did not mention, being bitten. And digging around on the Board Game Geek site, I actually found there is a homebrewed Mina card created for The Fury of Dracula, to be clear, the original game. So, yes, you old-timers can play with her too, and the link will be in the show notes. So I actually played Fury of Dracula 3 times. Twice with myself as Dracula, and once where I played Lord Godalming. And I found that playing Dracula was very tense. I spent a great deal of time worrying that the other players were going to catch me. The other fear is that, which, I don't know, is not quite as pleasant, I guess, is that you might screw up and not reveal a card when you should, or move places when you shouldn't. I mean, I do want to be honest when I play this game. In the first game, I actually wrote down a list of where I was, just because the cards are face down and there's no way for me to have a reference otherwise. I will mention here that the penalties for screwing up are actually pretty severe. You suffer a kill result, unless it would actually kill you, in which case your blood points drop only down to 1. Your trail is completely removed, and your current location is revealed. So all those encounters go away, and the hunters know exactly where you are. Still, when I was Dracula, I think I had more fun than the others did as the hunters. That may have been because I was more familiar with the game, or it may have been because I had nearly 100% information, other than the events and items that the hunters owned. I think I'm tending towards the former because everyone seemed to enjoy the third game. Or maybe I'm just a cruel Dracula. Who knows? As always, when doing a game of this complexity, I did mess up a few things in trying to explain it. One was not properly explaining how combat worked. I actually tried explaining it using the player aid chart, and that actually confused things because there was the chart and then there were the cards with the same information on them, and people didn't really understand what the correspondence was. I'd recommend sticking to the cards and then bringing out the chart if people want to get more strategic in their choices later, once they know the game a little bit better. The other issue is that in the first play, we didn't realize that combat items couldn't be reused in the next combat round. So there was a lot of rifle actions that shouldn't have happened. Basically, I was Dracula going against another player, and we were both using the same weapons over and over and over again until one of us just wore the other down. And that should not have happened the way it did. Overall, I really like this game. We've played a lot of cooperative games in my game group, and I actually get a little tired of them after a while because there's only so much that a game system can throw at you. I'm looking forward to the Arkham Horror expansions for this reason in particular. So, with the addition of a player as the antagonist, I find it more challenging and more interesting. It's also better than the other games we've tried, like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, although, to be fair, we only played once, and the Sauron expansion for the Lord of the Rings cooperative game. And that one we did give a fair shake to, where the bad guy is just too powerful, so it's no fun for the other players. In this one, Dracula did have the advantage in the first two, but that was partially because I was more familiar with the game, and partially because the hunters hadn't quite figured out how to work together. In the last game, it was a thrilling chase for Dracula, with the hunters planning and working together, and it eventually ended in a hunter victory. Now, the one frustrating problem I had with the current version, and I think I alluded to this, is that as Dracula, it can be hard to move about. If you're not careful, you can box yourself in because you've run out of places to go. In the original, you can pretty much go where you like as long as it's by road or by sea. For that alone, I think I'd like to try the original system just to see how it works. My one concern about the original system is that it might be harder to track down Dracula as you really only have one piece of trail to follow. And encounters, as I mentioned, block discovery of Dracula even if you're in the space. And since a common complaint about the current version is that it's too hard for the hunters, which I don't think it is if they work together, I worry it might be less fun than the original, at least for the hunters. But for now, the Fantasy Flight version satisfies my Jones for a semi-cooperative game with a nice, juicy theme, dripping with... Oh, I can't say it. Blood. There you go, Jason. I'll be right back with some comments right after this.
Here at Newtown Radioactive, we grow our science fiction the old-fashioned way. Whether it's your pseudo-cyberpunk dystopian future,
there are fields, endless fields, where human beings are no longer born. We are grown.
Or dark mysterious oozes lurking beneath the surface of the Earth.
That is not water. Black blood of the Earth. Blood of the Earth.
Or our ongoing experiments into alternative fuels.
This is heavy duty, Doc. This is great. Does it run like on regular unleaded gasoline?
Unfortunately, no. It requires something with a little more kick. Plutonium!
You can rest assured that Nuketown uses only the finest speculative fiction and geek ingredients in our homegrown podcasts. Join us every other Monday for speculative fiction and game reviews, geek commentary, and whatever else we decide to ramble on about.
Listen, we found some beryllium on a nearby planet. And we might be able to get there if we reconfigure the solar matrix in parallel for endothermic propulsion. What do you think?
Nuketown Radioactive, because if it's not glowing, it's not good for you. Check us out at www.nuketown.com/podcast.
All right. I didn't get many comments on Barbarian Prince, other than basically, great show! So, not sure I have much to respond to there, other than, thank you! I did get a few interesting questions in email, though, so I'll address those here. From Carl Gibbons, I got, a much aligned niche in games are the, quote, merchandising tie-in games. You know, they're the ones published hoping to cash in on the popularity of a movie, television program, best-selling book, or other cultural phenomenon. For the most part, such games, and the coattail-riding corporate marketing jerks that foist them upon us, tell us how you feel, Carl, deserve their reputation. But isn't there at least one gem in that genre? Have you played a vintage merchandising tie-in game that you thought was excellent or outstanding? Something that had fun gameplay, innovative mechanics, was true to the substance and experience of its source material, and is still fun today? If so, please consider making it the subject of one of your enjoyable podcasts. Conversely, if you've played a merchandising tie-in game that was so incredibly bad that the usual stuff looks good by comparison, that might make a painful yet fascinating podcast topic as well. Thanks again for the podcast. And he mentions three tolerable games and three wretched ones. The tolerable ones being Simpsons, Bart's Nightmare, Family Feud, and the Harry Potter Levitating Challenge. And the bad ones as Casper the Friendly Ghost, Battlestar Galactica. Battlestar Galactica again, how about that? And E.T. So, you're welcome, Carl, for the podcast. I can't say I've played any of those. Of course, I've heard the tales about E.T. Actually, I might have played Family Feud a long time ago. But some merchandising tie-in games, I do think... Actually, I think this would make a good podcast topic, just as sort of a, you know, here's a list of merchandising tie-in games. So I don't think I'll go in too much detail here, but there are two good ones I can think of off the top of my head. There's Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which I already mentioned during this podcast. And actually, I know this might not be what you're thinking of, but War of the Ring. War of the Ring is a merchandising tie-in game, and it's widely regarded as a faithful adaptation of the book. I've had a lot of fun playing it, too. But I'll think on the topic a little bit more, and you might see a podcast about that later. Now, from Jeff Paulson comes, I just wanted to drop you a note expressing how much I've enjoyed your podcasts and am looking forward to more. I also wanted to tell you about a computer game that I bought around a decade ago and have continued to play it. It is a graphical roguelike game called Ragnarok. I was pleased to find a wiki entry on it at Wikipedia. It is now considered abandonware, so if you find you have some time, give it a shot. There's actually a link from the Wikipedia entry page. It is a DOS game, but I have found that it runs on Windows 95, 2K, and XP as well, without any need for emulator. And he goes on to talk a bit more about how you need to carefully focus on powering up the character to survive the later part of the game, and how that really keeps his attention and why it keeps him playing the game. Thanks, Jeff. I played a lot of Rogue Hack and Moria back in the day, so I'll definitely try to check that one out. I think our Unix system had hacks, so I played that mostly as the tourist, just for the novelty of it. I mean, you get to walk around with a camera using your flash as a weapon. And, of course, I died a lot because it's a camera using a flash as a weapon. And as I think upon it, I think roguelike games might be worth a podcast on its own as well. Well, anyway, I'm always a little squirrely about getting abandonware because of the copyright issues. I mean, I do work in the computer game industry myself. But I will see if I can try to track down a copy of Ragnarok. And I'm glad you enjoy the show. Thanks for sending an email in. Now, if you have feedback for The Vintage Gamer, you can leave comments on the website, which is www.thevintagegamer.net, or you can contact me directly via email at vintagejim@gmail.com, or via Skype. My username is jvsquare. Feedback is always welcome. And thus concludes yet another bloody episode of The Vintage Gamer. What was that? Anyway, our theme is performed by the trio Music of the Spheres and available on the album of the same name at magnatune.com. Your humble host is Jim Van Verth. The next episode of The Vintage Gamer will feature, well, I'm not really sure, but it won't be an 80s board game, I can tell you that. I'll figure it out, and until then, keep trying those new games, but don't forget to play the old ones. Thanks for listening.